Okay, hi, is everybody back?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. So we'll start by, well, I'll make the first announcement. I did it in the email, but we are now officially the Clean Network.
Yay.
We had really extensive conversations about this in early March and talked to all individually interested parties at that time and made the decision at that point, but we had decided also to do that survey that everybody very kindly responded to. And we didn't want to confuse, especially those people who were not involved in the ongoing conversations, with changing the name in the middle of the survey. So we held off to make it official until the survey was closed, which was last week. And I was at the CS Cube meeting in San Antonio just before NSTA. And so we officially made I thought having an energy talk was a good time to make it official. So we are now the Clean Network. So that's the first announcement. So are there any other announcements? People want to give updates about what happened at NSTA?
Sure, Tamara. I'd like to just say a quick thing. After you left the CS Cube meeting, the CS Cube community asked explicitly for the climate science community and those who work in and around climate and education to really be supportive of their implementation and adoption process, because they're going to need, briefing memos and backgrounders and key questions, helping them answer them as they go through the process. So I think, between Dan Barstow, myself, and Tamara, you were there. Maybe a handful of us should be, think about how we could be most helpful and coordinated in our response and support to the Council of State Science Supervisors. So.
Absolutely. I was there a couple of days before Frank was, and I actually talked to them about that exact issue. And Steve Pruitt was there. He's the one who led the development of the Next Generation Science Standards. And he also indicated to me that this community is going to need our support. And one of the things I was thinking about is that we might ask Steve if he might give a presentation on one of our telecons to address how from his perspective, with his deep knowledge of what is in the Next Generation Science Standards, things we might do to help facilitate that.
If I could, perhaps, Stephen is one person, but I'm thinking more, it's really moved out of the achieve space and over to the Council of State Science Supervisors. So, I mean, I know that Peter McLaren is no longer the president, but he was the president when most of this was happening. And, maybe the past president and the current president, or maybe a member of the Council of State Science Supervisors, that would want to really lay out what would be most useful and timely for them. But somewhere in that space, because, really achieve is kind of that the ball is now over at the council.
I see. Okay.
So,
And
just a thought.
it's just I think that Steve has very specific he just gave me the impression that he's been getting questions and might have a bigger picture of what the needs are, but certainly we could have them jointly give it, or I can ask them who might be the most helpful in this.
Well, Frank, this is Kristen. This is that very question actually is something that I know that I'm planning on having a meeting with John here in Minnesota, just to ask that question, how what is useful to you? This is what we have. These are the resources we have. And he knows, I mean, that's what we do here, but it's something I'm interested to hear about. And also with the idea of further partnership ideas kind of coming out of that to support teachers here. So
Absolutely.
I would be interested to hear on a larger level too, but I'll be happy to share what he has to say about that, just as far as from his perspective. Our layout isn't until 2018, I don't think, is when we would adopt, but there's work to be done beforehand.
Exactly. And
And
so,
go ahead.
Kristen, on that point, I think, the value of what, many, many members of our network are at state levels as well as national through the network. And I think, you know, just efficiencies of if somebody's already nailed an answer to a question that, you know, maybe you developed, Kristen, that, mm-hmm. you know, helping Scott when he engages in Washington State, I really think the spirit of what they were asking for.
Great.
Hey, this is Peg Steffen. Somehow I got disconnected, but I'm back on. I didn't get to go to NSK this year, unfortunately, but and a member of CS Cubed, and I thought that maybe it would be good since some of these states are rolling out things earlier than other states that we might be able to identify a contact person for each state or something that would help mm-hmm. to make sure that everybody has someone to go to. I mean, it seems a little overwhelming to say, hey, guys, you can come to us. That's not really developing a relationship, but what might work better is that each state has somebody within the network that's either within their state or has an interest in working with a partner like that on an ongoing basis to make sure they have their questions answered and they have, you know, opportunities to connect to resources and so on.
And you know, one other thing that might be very valuable, and you were sorely missed and many people asked for you, so just know that there was extensive Peg Steffen love coming from San Antonio.
Indeed there was.
But that said, is another piece of this that I think somebody in the network alluded to is that in each state, you know, the research enterprise that relates to this would also be important to know so that, you know, if you're in Kansas, you know, there's a researcher in Kansas who could support them as opposed to coming from federal voice or national or international might be also helpful. So, you know, Kristen, if you know of climate researchers in Minnesota, you know, as part of that local support team, you know, the more we can kind of knit that together for them, probably the more powerful that would be.
Oh, absolutely. That's my big dream project is really getting them us all together and doing some professional development here with all the great research that's going on, too.
And
so if anyone has the money for that, send it my way.
Well, this is Peg again. You know, a lot of states already have STEM advisory boards or groups that are working. So maybe finding the person that's responsible for that and making sure that you know someone's making introductions to that STEM.
Yeah, like there are a number of like STEM in Minnesota. We have the Minnesota STEM Coalition,
mm-hmm.
and we have a STEM. We have our science supervisor at the state level, but we also have a STEM state person.
Right.
Yeah, this is Don. I know that Will is our state lead on science at the state ed department, and I know that he was not able to go to the same time. I'm actually wondering a little bit if how well New York was represented there by people connected to state ed, and I have no idea about the answer to that question other than Will wasn't there.
This is kind of first question. Can I ask you again? You were talking before about talking to somebody in Minnesota about the NGSS adoption process. Who is the name of that person again?
John Olson was the lead here, and he's our state science supervisor, and he also was the lead with NGSS.
And then the other question I wanted to ask is Peg said, and I'm also a member of CS Cubed. Is anybody else on the call also a member of CS Cubed, just so we can identify the people that have a little more access?
Peter McLaren had asked for me to become an affiliate member. I don't know if that's the best use of our time given the density of other people, but
is it Frank?
Yep, it's Frank.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what I just became in Frank. It's not a long process. So anyway, I could tell you about that later. Are there any other announcements?
AGU session proposals are due Friday, I think.
Yes, they are.
So I've made for the K-12 group, and anybody from that group is on the call or not.
We have 9 sessions, and I believe all of them are on track. I had contact with everybody late last week. And so I think we're doing well there. And next year's NFTA deadline was yesterday, so hopefully everybody got their session descriptions in. Okay, so why don't we move on to today's presentation? Today we have Danelle Hogan is going to give us a talk about the energy literacy principles. Danelle is the Einstein Fellow in the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy in the Department of Energy. She's been working with us in the Clean Project for the past 6 months or so and hoping to get energy resources into the collection. So Danelle has taught physics in high school in Idaho and in Arizona, and she's received a number of awards along the way, and her latest activity is being an Einstein Fellow. And so, Danelle, with that, I'm going to turn it over to you. Her presentation is available on slides or in a Prezi presentation.
Thanks, Tamara, and I think a lot of people on the call maybe attended the webinar, so this isn't going to be much different from that, although I guess there's a couple of little updates with NGSS having officially been released. And so I apologize in advance for some of it being repeated, but I still think it'll be interesting anyway. And I should start by saying that, of course, I'm an Einstein Fellow and I don't represent the Department of Energy, so anything that I say is my opinion and my opinion alone. we do have, for those of you who Twitter, we have hashtag energy literacy, where you can track some of the conversation about what's been going on with energy literacy, which for now has been mostly me, but we hope to get other people involved there. And then even after I'm gone, people can get a hold of whoever comes in to do the energy literacy initiative here at the department by using that email address that's listed there, energyliteracy@ee.doe.gov. And I am happy to say, actually, that we selected another Einstein Fellow to come in after me, and I'm really excited about who we got. His name is Josh Snydman, and he's from California and has a big background on in environmental science and has done a lot of really incredible things. So at some point, I will introduce him to all of you. Getting started, energy literacy really came out of the May 2011 strategic plan for the Department of Energy, which finally listed energy literacy as a priority for the department. And kudos to Matthew Inman, who was the Einstein Fellow before me, who actually facilitated all of that. And I know a lot of you actually contributed to that discussion. And, of course, it falls in line with the other literacy frameworks, including earth science, ocean, climate, and atmospheric science. And we're most closely, most similar to climate literacy, thanks in large part to Frank, who really helped a ton in advising us on how to go through all the process, and especially for helping us wade through the process to get the 13 federal agencies that make up the USGCRP to sign on, which has been super helpful in leveraging support from those other agencies when we've needed it. So that's been really exciting. When we look at the energy literacy framework, we also point to the National Research Council's framework for science education and talk a little bit about teaching and learning and what we know about how people do learn. And, of course, we're calling for energy literacy, energy to be taught in an integrated systems-based approach, which I'm not sure how you can teach it otherwise. The framework itself is not something that you would read to become energy literate. So sometimes I think this confuses people. They want it to be something that they would read to become literate on energy, but rather it's really intended for educators. It's more like a standards like document that lays out what you would know and understand, but still you'd have to do quite a bit more to actually become energy literate. And we're happy to send out copies for people that are running professional development for educators. And educators is broadly defined as anybody who's engaging people around energy education. So we work with both formal and informal educators and people who are engaging audiences from K to gray, we like to say. So little kids and big kids and everything in between. When you look at the framework, there's seven essential principles, and they do cover the whole range from physical science to earth system science and biology, and then into the engineering and technology of energy. And then 5, 6, and 7 get into the social science aspects associated with the energy system, including economics, politics, and social factors that play into that, and how quality of life is affected by energy choices, and on and on. So again, it's that interdisciplinary idea about teaching energy. And when you look at those seven essential principles more closely, there's anywhere from 6 to 8 fundamental concepts that support each one of those, then with also a little description for each of those. And we won't have time to go through each one of those concepts today, but again, this is available online, and you can also order up to 5 hard copies for yourself, or if you need more than that, you can always contact me through that energy literacy email, and we can send you more. But this is the physics side of energy, so this is the much more typical, I think, what people imagine when they think about energy, is it being on the physics side. Or maybe that's my bias because I'm a physics teacher. Then we get into the Earth system science side, so looking at how energy flowing into and out of the Earth system affects weather and climate, and the movement of matter as well through those reservoirs. And then onto the biology side, so this is looking at how the sun really is that original source of energy, and how energy decreases as you go from producers to consumers at different levels, and also starts to look a little bit at how humans are a part of Earth's ecosystem and have an influence on the energy that's passing through it. The fourth essential principle is the technology engineering side of it, so this is how humans are actually using technology and engineering to transform energy and put it to use, what some of those limits are, and so on and so forth. So this starts to get into the engineering and technology side of energy. And then next we get into the social political stuff. So 5 starts to look at the decisions that are made regarding energy and how those are really systems-based approaches to making those decisions, or at least we hope they are. And that energy infrastructure has inertia. So what we already have in place and the history of what we have used as energy sources really determines in a lot of ways what we're going to be able to use in the future and how quickly we're going to be able to change from one primary source to perhaps different ones. And then it gets into political factors, environmental factors, and social factors. And we start to see that it's really pretty complicated. 6 continues on with the social science side, so it has to deal with the amount of energy that people are using depends on lots of factors, including how people are concerned about conservation and what they're doing with that, their demand for energy, and how behavior and technology and innovation can actually affect energy use, either to add to it or to decrease it, depending on the exact situation. And the last one has to do with how quality of life of individuals and societies is affected by energy choices. And this, of course, is a huge, huge topic. So we know that economic security, national security, and environmental quality are impacted by energy choices. And then also that access to energy affects quality of life. And sometimes this is an interesting place where sometimes we talk about how energy can be a gender issue, which is surprising to some people until you point out that in developing nations, a lot of the time, it's the women who bear the burden of having to collect firewood and be over the stoves and the cook stoves, inhaling the fumes for long periods of time. And so they are more adversely affected by that lack of access to energy than are the males in those societies. So it's interesting to open up people's eyes to some of those issues that they might not have really thought about before. In terms of other things that we have to support the framework, on our website we also have an alignment tool. So this is really just an Excel spreadsheet that has all of the fundamental concepts within it, and people can go through and indicate if their curriculum or program or activity either addresses, supports, or doesn't address the fundamental concepts, and then it will actually give them a spider graph, but I think it's actually called a radial graph or something like that. But this shows under those essential principles, how much of their program is really addressing the fundamental concepts, so it can point to some weaknesses or ways that they might be able to improve whatever their program is. So we've had quite a few people use that are trying to assess their programs to see if they're covering all of the energy literacy concepts, and have had some positive feedback on that. So it's a tool just to help people kind of see what they're doing. I will say that on my list of things to do is to actually carefully go through, now that they're final, the Next Generation Science Standards, and kind of see how we've done. I've spent a lot of time on the first two drafts, and now have had a good look at the second draft, but haven't really had a lot of time to thoroughly look at how much it covers, or does it cover everything that we want it to cover from the energy literacy side. Looking at the Next Generation Science Standards, again, you all may know that energy is a cross-cutting concept within the Next Generation Science Standards, and so it actually does come up in physical science, life science, and earth system science. And when you look more carefully at the elementary school level, and this has been updated since the final draft was released, you'll see that it shows up in kindergarten, second grade, fourth grade, and fifth grade, and there may be a few performance expectations that I missed along the way that have thinner threads that are linked to energy literacy, but these are the main ones. And again, my own personal opinion is that if energy is a cross-cutting concept, it's a little disappointing not to see it in first and third grade as well. But that was a decision that was made, so I suppose we'll live with it. Middle school, you start to see that it gets certainly more complex, and so this is where you start to see more of the photosynthesis, the biological side of it, also just deeper understanding in terms of energy transfers and all of that. So it looks at the physical science side. And then this is also where you first start to see discussion of human impacts that are related to energy choices and how that plays out. When you get to high school, the high school obviously it's pretty similar, actually, to what they're covering in middle school, only it goes a bit deeper and a bit wider. So now we start to see nuclear energy and the sun discussed in more detail, and the carbon cycle shows up again, photosynthesis shows up again, but the processes that they're talking about get more complicated with aerobic and anaerobic stuff and so on and so forth. So on the physics side as well, it gets into electromagnetism, how we actually create electricity. And so it just gets more in-depth, and also on the earth system science side as well, and much more emphasis on human impacts, which is good to see for sure. So that's the Next Generation Science Standards as they apply to K-12. Here at the Department of Energy, we also have an Energy 101 initiative, and just last Wednesday, we had a webinar on Energy 101. We're happy to announce, actually, that with the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities and also with the Environment and Energy Studies Institute, there's now an Energy 101 course framework, which has been based on the Energy Literacy Framework. And, of course, it's an interdisciplinary systems-based approach that we're calling for with that as well, to teach the fundamentals of energy at the general education freshman level college university course. And so we actually have the University of Maryland in College Park running a pilot of a course that we'll be finishing up in May that's been pretty successful so far and has a pretty diverse group of students that are taking it. And then Harford College, which is a community college in Maryland, has a course that's been approved and also accredited with the University of Maryland so that it'll be transferable to lots of different places, which is really important. So if you're interested in that effort, that web address that's listed there for Energy 101, eventually the webcast that we just did will be archived there. It'll take them a little bit to get that posted. So I would say probably by the end of next week, you'll be able to find the details about that. But on the website, you can also find links to the Energy 101 forum for professors that are designing classes and just having discussions about everything from, you know, what textbooks are people using for these courses to what are some of the actual modules that they're using. And part of this effort is really to take better advantage of the National Training and Education Resource, which I'll talk about in a bit. Resources that are available that are more on the government side of things are Bites, which you did have Austin Brown come on and talk, so hopefully a lot of you heard that. Other, I'll show it again just quickly, but not go super into depth. Also, of course, the Energy Information Administration has a bazillion resources, so I'll highlight a few of their best ones, including a state's profile page that just went from beta to live, which I think is really great. Again, I'll talk about the National Training and Education Resource and then our website here at Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. So the BITES tool, Building Industry Transportation and Electricity Scenarios tool, is really pretty it's amazing to me. Like, I think there's a ton of information that's in there that you can engage students with around the topics of energy. So essentially what it allows people to do is go into those four sectors, building, industry, transportation, and electricity, and adjust different settings. And so in this case, this is looking at the buildings sector. They can adjust, you know, the improvements to new buildings, the percentage of existing buildings that are retrofitted by 2050, and so on. And then they can actually generate a scenario. And when they generate, and they can go into each of the four sectors to make adjustments and then run a scenario. And that scenario will come to the summary page and talk about, you know, how many emissions, and these are CO2 emissions, have been reduced by 2050 based on the selections that they've made. What is their energy use reduction by 2050 and oil use reduction? And so they can really play around with different settings to see what will have the biggest effect in those four sectors. And this is just basic mode. If you actually go to advanced mode in Bites, it gets really, really complicated. And then this is an example looking at the choices that people have made and how it affects primary energy source dependence. So you can see that petroleum, which is the green on the bottom, has decreased. And so whatever the choices that I selected in that particular scenario decreased our petroleum use. And this is all backed by an Excel spreadsheet that was designed by the folks at National Renewable Energy Lab for the Department of Energy to be able to make predictions about how some of these policy changes would affect CO2 output and primary energy source dependence. And then they've put this nice user interface on it. They're still designing curriculum to go along with it. And in fact, I'm personally working on one that will be based, that will be at the high school level, which should be available by the end of next week. So when that's done, I'll certainly send it out to the group. I will say it takes a little bit of time to work through how the website functions and how you might best use it with your students, but I think that it can open up a lot of conversation. One of the questions I get a lot is, does it then say anything about how much any of those changes might cost? And the answer is no. That's super complicated. And of course, being this massive system, there's lots of feedback to other sectors when you make changes. And so it doesn't have that kind of functionality, but I still think that you'd be able to talk about that with students and could engage them with those conversations. It also has an advanced mode where instead of just having a few selections for each of those four sectors, it has lots and lots of really detailed selections that also jump not just straight from now to 2050, but from now to 2030 and then to 2050. So students can decide how they're going to step up those different changes, how quickly they'll happen, and so on. And that just opens up a ton more functionality. You might use that with some advanced high school students, or you might have college students go in and look at that just to see what the possible technologies are related with all of those different things. But it definitely can get really complicated really quickly when you're in the advanced mode. But it is something that makes this a tool that could be used, I think, all the way up to the graduate level. So that's bites.nrel.gov. And I will say that they're really great about getting back to people. And this is a tool that's still in beta. So if people have feedback or suggestions or ways that it could be more usable for educators or students, they're happy to hear those and listen to that commentary. And again, Austin Brown presented on this to the Climate Literacy and Energy Awareness Network not too long ago, and so you can also look at that archived presentation. Of course, the Energy Information Administration is a great, great, great source for up-to-date energy statistics and information and stuff like that. So they have their Energy Kids site and Energy Explained sites. these are pretty much mirror sites, except for the Energy Explained is aimed, I guess, at the adult population, doesn't have the cool energy ant, but mostly people like the Energy Kids site, even if they are adults, because it includes most of the same information, and it's funnier to look at, I guess. But those are two sites that are really great for just general energy information and background information that people might need. The State Energy Profiles page, which is at the bottom there, eia.gov/state, is really great. And I'm sorry that I don't have a screenshot of it, but essentially what it does is it allows you to pick any state in the United States, and then it breaks down their energy use. So I can see how Idaho is mostly powered by hydropower, and then states on the East Coast, how their energy profiles differ dramatically from ours out in Idaho. So you can also look at, besides overall energy consumption, you can also look at energy consumed for electricity and so on and so forth. It also gives you some interesting facts about that state in particular. So it's a really great site for being able to make energy really place-based, or to do regional comparisons on what different states might be relying on in terms of primary energy sources. So I highly recommend it. And again, like I said before, it just went from beta to live just a couple weeks ago, which is exciting. The National Training and Education Resource was actually backed and developed by Department of Energy, but you'll notice that it's a .org, which makes it easier to function, I guess. Enterlearning.org is an open-source web-based learning platform, and it was originally really meant to be used for workforce development, and there's some really great courses on there for doing blower door tests or training people on the building codes associated with solar panels and lots of other great stuff. And it opens up a lot of functionality in terms of 3D modeling and having people, for instance, in the blower door course, people actually walk through a virtual house, turn things off, close this, do that, and then run the blower door test. And it's assessing them as they're walking through that house and doing what they're supposed to do. And it will tell them what they missed, and then they can try it again. So it's really interesting. I mean, I think it's functionality that hasn't really been put to full use yet. As I said, for that Energy 101 initiative, we're really hoping that professors will start to use this platform to design modules that then other professors might be able to use. And so our pie-in-the-sky kind of image of Energy 101 is that there would be a series of modules that people could pick and choose from, and then also they could create their own to make it more place-based for what they need, or make it more technical if that's the if that's the part of the school that they're teaching it from, or make it more social science if that's the part they're teaching it from. But if that's not their background, so for instance, if they're an engineering professor and they're not on the social science side, that there would be some model modules that help students learn about those social science aspects of the energy system with the correct background and all of that. And also more broadly, the hope is that much like the resources on Clean Air Vetted, that these modules would actually be vetted by both experts and educators before they're included in a listed collection, so that people would know that they can trust them. So that's kind of the longer-term goals. Right now, again, we're happy that University of Maryland and Harvard College are piloting some courses for us and hope to see that expand. And we've talked with lots and lots of university and college professors, and there's already quite a few courses taught that definitely are kind of Energy 101-like, and so we're challenging them to look at the Energy 101 course framework and see if they're covering all of those principles, and then trying to push that conversation to make those courses more interdisciplinary and systems-based, so that hopefully more of our citizenry is actually energy literate in the end. We can all wish. And so our site, of course, has lesson plans as well as information about energy literacy, Energy 101, and different programs and scholarships and competitions that students can get involved with. And I would say those are competitions that include things from K to 20. So some of the competitions, things like the Clean Energy Business Plan Competition, which is actually holding its regionals right now. So a few of them have already been completed, and some are wrapping up in the next month or so. But a great way for university and graduate students to propose a clean energy business and potentially get some funding for it, as well as the solar decathlon. And there's a wind competition that just started up from our Office of Wind here. And I think that might still be open for application. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on the competition side that's interesting. And then, of course, lots of career information and links on there as well. I think I'm preaching to the choir when we talk about why does energy literacy matter. I think the most disturbing thing to me from the 2002 Roper study that has pretty much been repeated and verified that we haven't made much progress to make our citizens any more energy literate is that about 75% of people think that they are pretty energy literate, but only about 1 in 10 actually pass a basic, not science and technology based, but just a basic energy test on where does your energy come from or how does it work or what's going on. And so we have a lot of work to do, I think, in order to get people to understand energy and how it impacts all of us. So we will continue on with that, and hopefully with all of your help. Here is, again, contact information and all of our website where you can find both Energy Literacy and Energy 101 stuff. And, again, for those who have stepped into Twitter, there's our hashtag for Energy Literacy. And that's really all I had today. Any questions?
I have a quick question for you.
Yeah.
So in the BITES tool, was that based on the scenarios that were laid out in the Energy Future study?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that they did rely on some modeling. I think it was mostly based on the annual Energy Outlook reports. But you can certainly email Austin Brown at that BITES email address, and he would have a better answer for you.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is in the Energy Futures study, they do lay out the possibility, if I remember correctly, that you could go to 80% renewable with the inclusion of pushing a large section of the transportation sector into the electrical grid. By 80% renewables by 2050, which is under 40 years from now. So I haven't played with the BITES tool to see if that's kind of would you get that out of that.
Well, and so there are definitely some limits. I know, so they won't let you, for instance, ramp stuff up to like 100%. You can't like ramp it up to 100% for every setting. So there are some logistical limits based on whichever model they were using. But, again, I can't say if it was that one in particular.
Right. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Janelle, this is Anna Gold. I looked at your Energy 101 course, and you said there was a framework, and I went to that link that you provided, and I don't see a framework, and it's not quite clear to me what the framework and what this course is. Could you just talk a little bit more about this? I'm very curious.
Yeah, so the Energy 101 course is meant to be a gen ed course for college and freshmen. And so the first thing that we did was, we got the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities as well as the Environment and Energy Studies Institute to kind of sign on to help us out. And then Oak Ridge Institute for Science Education was also involved in that process and helping take the energy literacy framework, so all of those essential principles and fundamental concepts, and look at how you might go about designing a gen ed course for freshmen in college. And that's what the Energy 101 course framework is. So it breaks it down into 5 different sections instead of the 7, although it still covers a wide range of the fundamental concepts, although I will say it's not all of them. We're not trying to fool ourselves into thinking that it's just going to be one course that's going to make somebody energy literate either. So the Energy 101 course doesn't cover the entire range of fundamental concepts, but it covers quite a lot of them and gives students hopefully a taste and some foundation in energy that would allow them to study things further. And so another one of our goals And this is much longer term, especially based on how College Board works and how slow this process can be. One of our longer term goals is to eventually, hopefully, have an energy AP course, advanced placement course, that would fall in line. We all know that advanced placement and environmental science is one of the fastest growing courses, and I personally think that the reason for that is because the math level is pretty low, and kids really love environmental science, and it's an easy thing to engage them around. I think the same thing is also true, or could be true, with energy. I mean, I think if the energy one, the advanced placement energy course was designed using that Energy 101 course framework that we've put together, it would be super engaging, not super mathematical, and yet allow students kind of an entry point into further energy studies. And so that's our longer-term goal. I will for sure, though, send out the direct link to the course framework so that you all will have that.
Okay, thanks. That's cool.
Jason Cervenek at Bird Polar at Ohio State. Looking at the document, I think it's wonderful that there's finally a cohesive place that ties in a lot of different disciplines. One of the things that I'm going to note, and this is just I came out of the classroom this year after teaching for 11 years physics and chemistry and bio, is I guess the extent to which language and misconceptions maybe have even played a role in this document. Looking through some of the stuff that's here, some of our language with, looking at standard one, with energy coming from different forms and identifying some of the forms there and then kind of breaking into two categories of kinetic and potential. And some of what we teach, one of the challenges I used to have is in physical science, students come in with a laundry list from their eighth grade curriculum of geothermal energy and solar energy and coal energy and nuclear energy and natural gas energy. And then when they come to physical science, you start talking about them kind of into the discrete categories you typically put them in physical science. And then they get to biology, and we still talk about energy being stored in high-energy bonds. And kind of this narrative that we have of energy, how within the sciences we are able to clarify the language, increase the representational tools for teaching it, because kids are really getting a vastly different story of energy in physics and chemistry that they're getting in biology, that they're getting in earth sciences. And they're almost partitioning it off into different ways of understanding energy that in some ways are completely inconsistent. And just looking at the document, there's a number of places that I'm looking at things that it's like these ways of wording things are kind of playing a role even in the drafting of the document here.
It's tough. I'm a physics teacher as well, and so I totally understand your frustration with how students learn things, and then when you get to them, what you have to do with that. And it is a difference between sources and forms of energy, and then the difference in how we talk about energy in the different sectors. So it's definitely a challenge, and certainly when it comes to the document itself, we are absolutely of the mind that it's a living document that is open for suggestion and change based on, if there's something that could be better, we're happy to have that. So, for instance, one thing that we're considering is in one of the descriptions, it doesn't do the best job, and I can't remember which one it is right now, but it doesn't do the best job of pointing out that in the carbon cycle, when you're burning fossil fuels, that it's a net gain as opposed to, it's in there, it's been a part of a carbon cycle, but now it's a net gain in terms of carbon in the system. And so that's something that we're looking at changing in the 2.0 version. So if you do have very specific suggestions on this, that, or the other, we're happy to look at those and really consider them. But it's a challenge. I mean, it's definitely a challenge thinking about how you actually present those. And I will say, as I'm sure you're aware, you're not going to get every science teacher, physicist, chemist in the room to agree on that either. So it's tough. I mean, but again, we're really open to suggestion as well.
Okay. Yeah, it's more of a, I always hate to point out things without a solution to it. But I think this is a good step because we've had such a poor energy narrative in the past and a way of tying in different content areas. But it's interesting that it's so deep-seated that there's even stuff in here that I'm looking at that it's taken me a number of years to come to terms with. But, the idea in biology, we still talk about high-energy bonds. But if you look at chemistry, which has the better message that there are no such thing as what does a high energy bond mean? Because you don't store energy in bond configurations that way. So, yeah, but it's a good way to finally have a more consistent message that's all inclusive in one document. So thank you.
Yeah, and I will say also we have some exciting projects going on with other groups. So we have a group out of California called EcoDad, and they're actually doing a lot of exciting work with iBooks and the California EPA. And they have they've actually talked about turning the energy literacy framework into an iBook itself that would then be something that people could use as an energy primer to become energy literate. And it'd be very interactive and interesting and fun. So we're excited about that possibility. It's not really reality just yet, but we're even excited about the conversation. Another really cool project that is definitely moving forward, we have just signed a memorandum of understanding with the Wilson Center here in D.C. and also Focus the Nation, which is a cool group, Focus the Nation out of Portland, Oregon, that is working with university and college students to become energy leaders. And they don't just engage STEM science background students, but rather also storytellers and politicos and people like that. And so they're working with us to actually, and the Wilson Center is the lead on this, to design an online energy game that would hopefully, in a fun and engaging way, be very educational in terms of the science of energy as well as the policy of energy. So the Wilson Center has a Serious Games initiative, which already has a really successful budget hero game, which shows people how the national budget works with real models and is pretty accurate. But, of course, the challenge when you get to energy is that people don't understand units and they don't understand energy, the science of energy. So you have to get them that first, and then start to talk about the policy side of it. So we're excited about that. We don't yet know what it'll look like exactly, but we're really starting to have conversations about what will it focus on and what will be the big takeaways that people will get from that game. But it's exciting that we're looking at that because I have looked at a lot of the energy games that exist already, and some of them are done pretty poorly and with some misconceptions in there that are really not great. And so we're excited that they're really concerned about making it accurate, educational, but also very, very fun and engaging as well. Anything else?
Yeah, Danelle, one quick point. The point you made about carbon. I think one important point is the idea of you know, the planet is not having a net gain of carbon atoms. It's just a movement from, you know, the long-term inorganic carbon cycle reservoir into the atmosphere.
Right.
The atmosphere has a net gain, but not the carbon, but the overall carbon cycle. I think I said that correctly. I'm sure somebody else would correct me if I didn't.
Hey, and don't worry, Frank. I won't change anything related to the carbon cycle without having some people vet it first. You, of course, are on that list.
Yeah, we got people. We got people.
Yeah, I know.
But you know, it's just funny that you know one thing I would, you know, we've already, I think we're all on the same page here. But I think I just got to say again that having the energy literacy framework to complement the climate literacy framework is a real huge positive gain for us as a larger community. And the fact that we've just today announced that we're, you know, merging the two communities' networks into one network, you know, that's another really positive and encouraging thing, because there's things that are in the energy that were really never right in climate. And I think that the two really complement each other very nicely. So, you know,
I mean, we're definitely excited about that. And I think the conversations are great. I think there's also, you know, there's an interesting conversation about, you know, how does climate, energy, and environmental education all kind of fit together, work together, because they have been kind of siloed, you know, areas in the past, and they're obviously related. And so I think those are all really interesting conversations, and I'm hoping that the Office of Science, Technology, Policy might actually get involved with that conversation and push harder to get it included more.
Well, it's interesting because there was a editorial in the Science this week by the president of American Chemical Society to that effect, that, you know, their role, that they see chemistry how climate change should play a role in chemistry education and energy as well. Like they're trying to rethink that with environment in mind.
Can you send the link to that out to the network?
Yeah.
That'd be awesome. The one, Danelle, I think there's one other interesting piece of, I agree with you, but the STEM focus that we have in the President's FY14 budget, and I was just at a STEM meeting, and I think of the, you know, from a tactics or strategy perspective is, how does, you know, STEM for what? STEM sometimes is, you know, when you think of STEM, and I did this at this 110 meeting, and usually you think of, you know, lab coats or Lego robots or robots, you know, shooting basketballs.
Right.
In STEM. And, you know, that it's STEM for who and STEM for what? And are all students going to be STEM literate? We've introduced a new word into our community, and yet it's a very fuzzy word. And yet when you talk to people who talk about STEM, it's a lot of times it's we want STEM to solve the problems of the, you know, that we're facing, but it's a fuzzy, hard space to kind of make that clear. So it, you know, I'm vigilant here, but it's still a space that has yet to be connected all those dots. But I agree with you.
Yeah, and of course Mark McCaffrey is doing a ton of great work to bring the climate and energy communities together, and so we're excited to continue our work with him as well.
Great, very good. Is there any other questions? Okay, if not, well, thank you very much, Danelle. You gave us a lot of a very good overview of the energy literacy principles and a lot of resources and possible avenues of collaboration. So we greatly appreciate that.
Quick question for Danelle. Danelle, when do you transition on the Einstein Fellowship, and will there be an overlap between you and the new gentleman? I think it was the gentleman.
Yeah, so I'm done at the end of July, and I currently do not know where I'm going, but I'm hoping to get back to the West Coast because I'm from Oregon originally, so that's on the top of my list. But so I'll be done at the end of July, and hopefully, you know, I will for always and forever be involved with energy education, I guess, but just don't know exactly what my role will be after July. And then we actually don't overlap, so that was just kind of really fortunate that Matthew and I were able to overlap last year, but not typical. So there's a month of August where it's kind of nobody, and then he'll be in, Josh Snyderman will be in at the end of August, beginning of September. But I've already started to loop him into a lot of our conversations. And again, I think everybody's going to really love him, and he'll do a great job of taking this initiative over and really taking it to the next level. And he actually, one of the reasons we were excited to get him is because he's a fluent Spanish speaker and has done a lot of great environmental work in Costa Rica. And we, of course, are in the process of translating energy literacy into Spanish, as has already been done with climate literacy, and then engaging much more formally the Hispanic population. So he'll be a really great person to get that work done.
So Danelle, this is Tamara. If it might be useful, if you're in contact with him already, if you could do an email introduction with me, then we could potentially get him on at least the Clean Network listserv, and so he can sort of begin to see the kinds of things that are happening.
Absolutely. I will do that for sure.
And actually, Danelle, another thought that came to mind as you were saying that is that, you know, now that we have merged the networks, I would think that the majority of people that are on this network are climate-focused, but is there a way to invite members of the energy community to join us more explicitly and really, grow our ranks and balance out the focus?
Absolutely. So I think what would be nice would be to have kind of an official announcement about, you know, the Climate Literacy Network becoming the Climate Literacy and Energy Awareness Network. And then we will happily send that out to our listserv and get people to hopefully sign up. And then I also have a whole list of people that would also announce that through their own listservs and whatever. So if we could draft maybe a kind of an official announcement that has an announcement about it becoming clean, and then also a short version that would be Facebook ready, and an even shorter version that would be Twitter ready. That would be awesome.
Okay, sure. I can certainly draft the email, and we can talk about the shorter and shorter versions that might go out. So,
well, you can draft,
if
you draft the email, I'll do the Facebook and Twitter ones.
Okay, well, you just need to tell me what those are, too, and then I can put them out in other Facebook and Twitter avenues.
Yeah, because it's really nice to have those already kind of preset. Then people will be more likely to use them.
Yeah, okay. No, I will certainly draft an email that gets sent out to people that are not actually in the Clean Network at the moment.
Great. Awesome.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks a lot, Danelle, for all your efforts in moving this forward and for your presentation today.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks, everyone.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Thanks.
Thank you.